Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Gnostic Media's Unspun, episode number 77. I'm your host, Jan Irvin, and tonight we're joined by Mark Devlin. Mark had some internet trouble tonight, so we're running a little bit late. Everything up is 77. Up and running now. I'm your host, Jan Irvin.
And let me mute that.
Tonight we're
Hold on
joined
a second. I got a feedback loop
by
going.
Mark Devlin. Mark had some internet trouble tonight, so we're running a little bit. Sorry about that, folks. So got rid of that little issue. Anyway, we're here. Thanks to everyone for supporting the show and donating this last week. I really appreciate it. Call out to all of you. And glad to have you on, Mark. This was bound to happen eventually. I guess I've been on your show last year, maybe a couple times, and we've talked about having you on mine for a while. And so good to have you here.
Good to be here, man, eventually.
Welcome. So, you know, 5 minutes, you know, right before we're supposed to start the show, your internet goes off. So that's all right.
Would you believe it?
Anyway,
and I've stayed up specially as well. It's 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Yeah, so you're not exactly wanting to stay up, you know, extra late just to hold off, right?
Well, I guess we should just dive into it now, make the best of the time.
Yeah. All right. So, well, let's get going. You know, you sent me an article to read on how do you pronounce his name? Let's see here.
Africa Bambaataa.
Yeah, Africa Bambaataa, and which goes into all of this history. So we're going to kick off on that, and it's going to be more of, I think, what we've already been exposing here for several years at Gnostic Media, more on the music scene, more on the occult underside of things that the public doesn't hear much about. And so anyway, where do you want to begin?
Okay, well, just very briefly, I'm a radio and club DJ for many years, and a few years ago I turned my attention to researching the true nature of the corporate music industry and what it's used for and the groups and networks that really run it. And last year I put out my book Musical Truth Volume 1, and in it I've got a chapter titled The Systematic Degeneration of Hip-Hop Culture, because that's the way I see it. Basically, I've been a hip-hop DJ for the past 20 odd years. I've played all forms of black music, but hip hop is what I've been most known for. And what passes for hip hop today is nothing like what it was when I first got started in the game in the early 90s. What you've got now is a completely degraded, debased, toxified version of what went before. And you can see that in so many elements of it. You can listen to the sound frequencies and the production styles that are going into so-called hip-hop records now. And to my mind, it just sounds like garbage. It's just satanic. It's dark. There's all kinds of dissonant, discordant stuff going on with the bass lines, with the production methods. Then you can look at the lyrics, and the lyrics are just completely debased and degenerated and degraded as well. The only lyrical themes that you hear about in so-called hip-hop records now are just all about materialism, partying up in the club, drinking champagne, gold chains, various consumer brands that are pushed as part of product placement, you know. And it's just complete BS. It's completely detached from what it used to be. And it used to be a beautiful, meaningful art form, which when it first started really was inspiring to people. It uplifted them. There was a lot of message music. The music was meaningful, the messages were, you know, powerful like that, and all of that has changed. So I wanted to document that in this chapter of the book. But one thing that I really want to talk about right now, because it's topical, because it's ongoing, is this situation with this guy, Africa Bambaataa. So he's considered one of the founding fathers of hip-hop culture, alongside guys like Kool Herc and Grandmaster Flash, these legendary names from the early days of the 1970s in the Bronx, New York, where that whole art form grew up from. Africa Bambaataa was born in 1957, real name Kevin Donovan. He came out of the Bronx. He was a member of this organization called the Black Spades, which was like this kind of street group organization, this gang. And he formed a sort of offshoot of that known as the Bronx River Organization. And very quickly, this morphed into what became known as the Universal Zulu Nation. And he headed this organization up from the 1970s all the way through to 1994, when he was replaced as their leader. And this organization was all about taking young members of these impoverished black communities and bringing them into this group. And ostensibly, it was all about self-improvement, urban regeneration. It stated all kinds of positive means and principles and codes that it was all about. And they claimed that they were about taking young people that would otherwise have drifted into gangs, but instead of allowing them to fall into criminal activity, it was all about helping them to kind of improve their situation. The imagery and the kind of spiritual ethos of this group was rooted very much in Afrocentrism. So it was black people kind of rediscovering their African roots. And it was also very much an offshoot of Islam. And there are various facets of Islam that are specifically packaged towards black people. So there's the Nation of Islam organization, which Malcolm X was affiliated with, and Muhammad Ali was a part of that as well, way back in the day. And it's headed up by this guy, Louis Farrakhan, who's been the head of that organization for many decades now. And then you've got other offshoots, such as the Nations of Gods and Earth and the Uwabians. These are all kind of offshoots of the Islamic religion. So the Zulu Nation very much buys into all of that. And so you had this situation where Afrika Bambaataa was the spiritual leader of this organization. He put out a record which was very influential, very seminal in 1982, called Planet Rock. And it's considered to be very much a hip-hop anthem. Although when you get down to the music of that record, it's not really hip-hop at all. It's more kind of disco and funk. But it was very much seen as an anthem of that whole scene. So everything seemed to be all good. And Bambaataa, for a very long time, was seen as this icon, this figure that everyone in the hip-hop community looked up to. It all started to go a bit wrong early last year when this guy called Ronald Savage came forward and accused Bambaataa of sexually molesting him on an ongoing basis, dating back to 1980. And immediately in the wake of that, you had this other guy called Hassan Campbell, who was known as Brother Poppy. That was his kind of street nickname. And he also stated that Bambaataa had sexually molested him over an ongoing period, going back to the late 1970s. And he claims that he was the first to come forward with these claims. But the one that everyone has heard of is Ron Savage. And both these guys were, as I say, members of the Universal Zulu Nation. Ron Savage's street name was Bee Stinger. Then two more guys came forward with similar allegations of sexual abuse, basically child rape, because these guys were in their early teens when this stuff is alleged to have taken place, you know, like 12, 13, 14 years of age. So we've now got four guys that have accused this spiritual leader of the Universal Zulu Nation, Bambaataa, of, you know, sexual molestation. And it's all starting to get very ugly. In the wake of these accusations, you had another very legendary hip-hop figure, KRS-One, who stepped forward in defense of Bambaataa. And he basically made a statement to the effect that, I don't care what the guy did. I don't care if these allegations are true or not. It doesn't take anything away from his heritage and what he's achieved and his iconic status, which to me is not a very responsible statement to make. And there are others that feel
well, and KRS-One is extremely influential in the community as well. I mean, you know, I'll hear somebody mention, oh, if you want to hear really influential and positive hip hop, you should listen to KRS-One.
Right. Well, exactly. He's always had that kind of image. He's always been seen as a conscious rapper. He's been seen as a teacher. He's known as the Blastmaster KRS-One. He's seen as something of an educational force. And he's also claimed to have bettered many young hip-hop fans' lives by turning them onto knowledge of self. But, you know, this seemed to be quite a puzzling statement for him to make. There was also a video which emerged of him fairly recently where he stated that he's not a Freemason, but he is considered to be a 33rd degree Freemason by those within that fraternity, and he's been with great secrets pertaining to Freemasonry. Now, I've never been a Freemason myself either, but But from my understanding of how these secret societies work, you take oaths of secrecy when you join them, and you're not supposed to disclose the inner workings of that organization to those outside of it. So we've got this guy claiming that he's not a Freemason, but he's considered to be a 33rd degree one by those who practice it, and he understands all their secrets.
Well, that would be like maybe like Manly Palmer Hall was, I think, an honorary 33rd degree Mason or something like that. So maybe they gave him an honorary degree or something like that so that, you know, who knows. But it seems that I've seen some, I could be wrong, seen some Illuminati, pyramid eye, all-seeing eye type of stuff in KRS-One's work.
You see it in most of the artists that are prominent in that field, to be honest. And what you've had with the whole Bambaataa situation is this guy's image and heritage have really been tarnished in light of these accusations. And yet the mainstream have not addressed it in any kind of way. So all these hip hop stations like Hot 97 and Power 105 and WBLS in the States, no mention of it at all. Over here in the UK, Radio 1, Capital Extra, Kiss FM, all these stations that concern themselves with urban music and hip-hop culture, not a mention of it. You only get it in the alternative media. You've only got it from the videos that the likes of Hassan Campbell, Poppy, and this Ronald Savage guy have been putting out. But, you know, it's not looking good. And the implication here is that the whole Universal Zulu Nation, which took these young, disaffected youths off the street in the South Bronx, brought them into this organization, is starting to look like a cult, because it's bearing all the hallmarks of a mind control cult. You know, all the warning signs are there, lack of contact with the outside world. They're only encouraged to fraternize with their own kind, with those that are already in the ranks. There's a hierarchy there. You know, there's all kinds of sexual misdemeanors going on. It bears all the hallmarks of being a cult. So now we have to ask ourselves, is this what's been going on all these years with the Universal Zulu Nation?
Well, you know, the question I have, let me ask you this, Mark. The question I have is, you know, you talk about the quality of music degrading and all, but, you know, like since the times of Grandmaster Flash, et cetera, to now, but was it always started with that intent? I mean, you know, when I look at, say, for instance, the Grateful Dead, and we did the series on that, and we did the series Music, Mind Control, and Psychobiology, which you may have seen. And, you know, we see this rampant throughout the music, all the way back to Harry Smith and those guys doing the thing for the, you know, the Smithsonian.
Right. Well, this is the question. It's not...
We're getting some weird feedback from somewhere. I don't know where that's coming from.
Okay, some I don't
buzz. There's a buzz going on there.
I'm not getting that my end. Yeah, well, this is the question. How organic or grassroots was that whole movement? And was there a point where it was infiltrated by certain parties that wanted to run certain agendas? I personally feel that it did start off very natural with positive intent, but there was a point where, you know, just that happened. I do want to mention another interesting affiliation of Bambaataa's as well, who, by the way, is on the run. Nobody knows where this guy is. When Ronald Savage came forward with his accusations, first of all, he says that he was contacted by two senior members of the Zulu Nation who offered him $5,000 to retract his statement about Bambaataa. And when he stated that he wasn't interested in the $5,000, they upped the price to $50,000, hoping that they could buy his silence that way. And he made it clear that he wasn't out for money at all, and he just wanted to get his story out, and he wanted to help other people have been victims of sexual abuse in the same way. So that's kind of interesting that they tried to buy his silence. But I just wanted to mention this interesting affiliation. Back in the early 80s, Africa Bambaataa had an association with Malcolm McLaren. And Malcolm McLaren is a very interesting guy to study. This goes into the work of Nino 210 and the Sonic Youth, who've looked into the punk and new wave scene. And McLaren, of course, was the manager of the Sex Pistols, very much caught up in that whole punk movement. So McLaren was very fond of telling this anecdote of when he was living in New York City in the early 80s, he just happened to bump into Bambaataa in the street, he says, and they struck up a conversation. Bambaataa invited him along to this hip hop block party, and McLaren says he was captivated by the whole culture and the whole scene. And this led to him putting out a couple of hip hop inspired records, Buffalo Girls and Double Dutch, and the album that he did called Duck Rock. But when you get into some stuff with Malcolm McLaren, you discover some very unsavory connections there. So first of all, he was an early manager of the group Adam and the Ants. Adam Ant himself, Stuart Goddard, his father, Alfred Leslie Goddard, was a convicted paedophile. And he was affiliated to this network which ran out of Dolphin Square in Pimlico, London, close to where he lived. And this implicates a whole bunch of British politicians, particularly Leon Britton, who was on Margaret Thatcher's cabinet back in the 1980s. He's been involved in various allegations of sexual molestation of young boys. So Adam Ant's father was reportedly involved in procuring children for these elite sex paedophile rings. And there are connections between him and this notorious paedophile called Sidney Cook, and also, surprise, surprise, Jimmy Savile. So there's the first link there between McLaren and Adam Ant.
You know, Mark, let me just interject there. I can't help but remembering the cover of that Adam Ant album, you know, with him with, you know, if I... You know, through the ancient history, going through whatever. What's that song? I forget. It was really popular.
Stand and Deliver, or Prince Charming.
I wasn't Stand and Deliver, but it was it was him lying in a hay bale, all you know, all.
Oh, Puss in Boots. Puss in Boots.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but you know, oh man. So yeah, you're just connecting some more dots for me. That's kind of funny. I just wanted to mention because the. The cover of his album even shows some of this stuff, as do the lyrics.
Well, yeah. I mean, we connect dots all day with this stuff. There's also the situation with McLaren where he went on to manage this group called Bow Wow Wow, and they had a 14-year-old girl as their front person called Annabella Lewin, and McLaren photographed her nude at the age of 14 for one of their album covers. There's also a story that I relate in the book where Malcolm McLaren coerced a 12-year-old girl into stripping naked for a photo shoot. And the other interesting thing about him is that he put out a pop and fashion magazine with backing from the EMI record label in the early 80s, initially called Play Kids, but changed soon afterwards to Chicken. And it was described as pleasure technology for the primitive boy and girl. So anyone that's looked into the recent Pizzagate scandal would be familiar with the term chicken as code word used by paedophilic groups for a young boy. And that's the title that McLaren chose for his magazine. So I'm connecting Bambata and McLaren here, and people might say, oh, you're just making them guilty by association. And I know that that's a common phrase that you often hear bandied around, but another common phrase that you often hear is that you can judge a man by the company that he keeps. And I think there could be a bit more to know there.
So yeah, just very quickly, that song was Puss in Boots. That song was Stripped,
right?
You know, okay. Which you know fits the whole theme.
Absolutely. So the whole Universal Zulu Nation thing, you know, it affected the lives of hundreds or thousands of young men. It had a very strong cultural impact. There are offshoots of the Zulu Nation all around the world. They've got networks, particularly in Paris, London, all over Europe, and many other, you know, parts as well. And I've come to realize that when any kind of fad or trend or movement has that kind of reach and that kind of impact and influence on large numbers of people, you can bet that it's been created and it's working according to some kind of social engineering agenda or other, because these things are just not allowed to evolve that way on their own. I know you understand that, but you know, this is something that has very much come across my radar. So I'm asking all kinds of questions now about what that was all about. And, you know, if this is the spiritual, cultural, iconic leader of an art form, what does that now say about the art form? A lot of people are finding it very difficult to acknowledge this aspect of Bambata because people don't like to have to let go of their heroes. And when it comes to hip hop, he was definitely a hero. And you've said to me before, Jan, but that everybody has somebody that they don't want to hear it about. And there are so many people in the hip hop community that are in denial about this whole thing, but it is what it is.
I just got in an argument with somebody the other day over Bono and U2 because they're going to be playing in San Diego, you know, and I was like, well, you know, Bono's Dirty, and I said, you know, do you like the Police? And they said, yes. I pull up the Brain database and show, you know, Stuart Copeland, Miles Copeland, right into the CIA, you know. And, right. You know, they just don't want to hear it, you know. They just can't even fathom that, you know. And see, this is why I question this guy, Bambata, however you pronounce his name, because he's running a cult. It has all of the typical signs of an intel operation from the get-go rather than an organic growth.
Right. Exactly. It's difficult to pinpoint the fingerprints of the intel agencies specifically with this particular story. That doesn't mean it's not to be found.
Right.
It may be uncovered at some later stage. There's nothing that's come across my radar yet to connect this specifically with one of the intel organizations, but, you know, stranger things have happened. And there are many other elements of hip-hop as well. So Bambata was also an affiliate of this guy, Dr. Malachi York, who is another alleged pedophile. He's currently in jail. He's serving 135 years on a whole bunch of charges that were thrown at him several years ago. He's also a teacher of a kind of offshoot of Islamic doctrine, the New Warbian movement. And he's also said to have inspired many other characters and rappers within the hip-hop scene. So he was also a teacher and an inspiration to a rapper by the name of Prodigy, who came out of the group Mobb Deep. And Prodigy claimed that Dr. York schooled him in all kinds of knowledge and truth. An interesting thing about Prodigy is that on the 20th of June this year, he just happened to turn up dead in Las Vegas after having been hospitalized a few days earlier. And his death has been put down to a long-standing condition that he had with sickle cell anemia. And it's well known that he battled with this disease for the whole of his life. But the thing about Prodigy is that many years ago, he came out and started speaking about the Illuminati, his words, and the New World Order agenda, and the whole kind of elite control of the entertainment industry.
He's Mark,
spoken about this.
Who was that? Who was it about 6-8 months ago that came out on stage and blew the lid on everything? A hip hop artist, and then they shuffled him off to the asylum. Who was that again?
Well, that was Kanye West.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kanye West was on stage in Sacramento, California. I think it was about November last year. It's around about the time of the U.S. election. And he started rambling incoherently about all kinds of things. He was talking about Trump, basically saying he supported Trump. Then he started talking about Jay-Z. And he spoke about him in terms of him being his mind control handler.
Well, you know, that actually makes sense with my own research that he was that Jay-Z was his handler. I mean, we've come up with that hypothesis with other people like Beyonce, you know.
Right. Well, Jay-Z brought Kanye into the game, so that's certainly possible. He put him on the map. So Kanye's ranting about all this stuff, and he says, "Jay, don't be sending those killers up in my head now." And he says that twice, as if Jay-Z's got some kind of control over his head, over his mind, you know. You
can read all monarch style.
Exactly. Monarch programming, which is absolutely endemic throughout the entertainment industry.
Absolutely.
It's no different to that. So you got this guy, Prodigy, who came out in late 1995 on the remix of an LL Cool J record where he dropped a guest verse. And he came out with the phrase, "Illuminati want my mind, soul, and my body." And then a few years after that, he started doing interviews. He was incarcerated for a few years in 2007, and that's where he said he started reading the work of Dr. York, and he got turned on to all kinds of truths about what's really going on in this world and who really controls the entertainment industries. So beyond that point, he started talking about the Illuminati, about these secret societies that run everything. He started getting very critical about Jay-Z. He called Jay-Z out as a Freemason. He said that Jay-Z has sold his people out. He's not true to his culture, to where he's come from. He's just playing the corporate Illuminati agenda. You know, very outspoken stuff. And then Prodigy just happens to die on the 20th of June, which is the day before the summer solstice, of course. And another thing that you come to realize is that a lot of these celebrity deaths, which happen very suddenly, happen on significant dates in terms of solstices, equinoxes, religious festivals, all that kind of thing. So a lot of people seem to accept that because this guy had been suffering with sickle cell anemia, we shouldn't be too surprised that it got the better of him and, you know, he died in the end. But I find the date suspicious, and maybe it's just me. Maybe it's my suspicious mind. But when somebody is that outspoken about these elements and these types of information, and they just happen to turn up dead, it makes me kind of suspicious. Going back to the Bambata situation, incidentally, there was another affiliate of the Universal Zulu Nation who has been making some videos recently confirming that Bambata is indeed a paedophile. And this was a guy by the name of TC Islam. And on the 8th of June this year, he just happened to show up dead in Atlanta. He's said to have been murdered. He turned up on a sidewalk in Atlanta, but there have been no further details given about the nature of his death. And there's been no police statement or coroner's report or anything like that. The only information we've got is that this guy that was connected with the case just happened to have turned up dead in Atlanta. So people can make of that what they will. One other thing which is topical, which is in the news at the moment, is a story that broke just yesterday, and it concerns R. Kelly. So R. Kelly is an R&B singer and producer. He's not a rapper, but he's been very much affiliated with the hip-hop scene. He did an album with Jay-Z. He's collaborated with a whole load of rappers. And he's been embroiled in all kinds of sex scandals throughout his career. So there are home videos which are said to have emerged of him in recent years, where he's urinating on teenage girls as part of what he considers to be some kind of sex game. Not my idea of a sex game, but maybe that's just me. And the other thing about R. Kelly is that he married the R&B singer Aaliyah when she was just 15 years of age in a ceremony which was later deemed to have been illegal and it had to be nullified. But this guy has a penchant for teenage girls and pre-teen girls, clearly. And there have been many, many cases which have come to light. He's never been convicted of any of these things, despite the fact that there's video evidence, there have been witness statements and testimonies to support the fact that he is indeed a paedophile, but nothing ever gets done about it. But this story emerged yesterday where he is said to have been involved with a whole load of women living together in this kind of communal arrangement, which again smacks of being some kind of mind control cult. So some of these women have come forward and said that he's very domineering, he's very controlling, he takes care of their money and he decides what money they get and when. He dictates when they can go out, who they can see, what they can do. And it seems to be a very strange kind of living arrangement that these women are involved in. So I wonder where this story is going to go. Is there going to be any kind of justice or any kind of action taken against him now, where he's escaped scrutiny in the past? But yet again, we have a prominent figure from this whole kind of music community involved in all these strange kind of sexual activities. And it doesn't look good. And it casts a very questionable light on the whole scene and what it's all about.
You know, Mark, when you take our work, you know, and you think of Pizzagate, you think of the Seville case, you think of the I think it was Norway and some other places, Brussels, they cleaned up or arrested, what was it, 400 pedophiles in the LA area a few months back. When you look at all of this going on, it starts to paint a broader picture that this is much more vast than most people presume to believe.
It really does. And it's only now that we're starting to uncover so much of this stuff, which has been right there in our faces for years, if not decades. These accusations against Bambata are going back to the 1970s. And you've got a whole bunch of people from the Universal Zulu Nation now who are saying, well, we all kind of knew what Bambata was up to. It was kind of an open secret, but nobody ever spoke out about it. And that, to me, is so reminiscent of the situation we had when the Jimmy Savile case broke in 2011 in the light of his death. So all these revelations about Savile having been a predatory paedophile only came to light after the guy had died. because it was only then that the victims felt safe enough to come forward, because they felt intimidated by this guy before that. They knew that he was connected. They kind of knew that nothing was going to be done for as long as he was alive. But what you had in that situation was a whole bunch of people that had worked at the BBC with Savile. And these would be other celebrities. These are other household names, other presenters, people like Esther Ranson, Terry Wogan, Bill Oddie. They were all coming forward and saying, well, yeah, we all kind of knew about Savile. It was an open secret in the BBC, but nobody ever talked about it. You might have seen this video featuring Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols, dating back to 1978. This has been widely circulated on the internet, particularly since the death of Savile. And in it, he's talking to this interviewer about all these people that he'd like to kill. So you assume it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. And he says, you know, there are all these people that I hate that I'd love to kill. And then he brings up Jimmy Savile. He said, I'd love to kill Jimmy Savile. I bet he's into all kinds of sordid stuff that we're not allowed to talk about. And he kind of gives this knowing look to the camera. So this suggests that back in 1978, Johnny Rotten was in full knowledge of what Jimmy Savile was all about, but nobody was talking about it then. And like I say, it's only now with the availability of research that's available to us on the internet that we're able to uncover these things. There's also this whole spirit, this whole zeitgeist now of citizen researchers, people just taking it upon themselves to look into this stuff. You don't have to be an established author or filmmaker or public speaker. Anyone can delve into this stuff and turn up some great results. I mean, Nino210, who you had on your show the other month with all his research into the punk and new wave scene, is a great example of that. And his associate, Masonic Youth, they've come up with some mind-blowing connections on the punk and new wave scene, going all the way back into secret societies and Yale and Harvard, Skull and Bones, US presidents, serial killers, all kinds of connections there. So why should it be any different in hip hop? You know, all these connections are just waiting to be uncovered, and many of them have been now.
Yeah, you know, there was a point I was going to bring up, and now I've forgotten what it was about tying all of this together. But then, yeah, I mean, it's just so vast. You know, thinking of Johnny Rotten and all of that. There was another case that I was thinking of, and yeah, it just slipped my mind. So, oh well, I'll think about it later. Right when you start talking about it, or you know, talking.
We're talking about connections. Johnny Rotten made a record with Afrika Bambaataa in 1984 called World Destruction. I'm sure it would have been curated by Malcolm McLaren, because McLaren was affiliated with both Johnny Rotten and Bambaataa, so I think he probably brought those two together. But, you know, interestingly enough, they actually made a record together. Do you want to get on to a little bit about electronic dance music?
Absolutely. Well? I thought you'd never ask.
All right, then. Well, let's get into that. So there's another anniversary this year, as well as it being the 50th anniversary of the Flower Power, Summer of Love, whole hippie scene, which you and I are going to talk about with Steve Eltrim in a couple of weeks on my show. It's also the 30th anniversary coming up of the acid house scene in the UK. So that whole thing got going at the tail end of 1987. And this very much paved the way for the worldwide phenomenon of electronic dance music that we now have, which literally it has been embraced in every continent around the world. It affects young people in pretty much every country around the world. It's absolutely a movement. It's absolutely a culture and a lifestyle. And as I mentioned earlier, whenever you get something like that, you can be sure that the hidden hand has played a role in it, because these things are not allowed to get that big and affect that many people if they're not serving some kind of agenda or other. So I really wanted to look into the parallels and the connections between the acid house scene and the EDM scene and the whole counterculture flower power thing from the 1960s. And there are many parallels. So the 60s was absolutely drenched in LSD at the hands of the CIA, as we well know.
Hey, let's not leave out the MI6 there, Mark.
And remind me, before we finish, I've got a Huxley connection for you, because I know you can't go through a show without bringing up a Huxley. So don't let me finish without bringing that one up.
Yeah.
So with the acid house scene, instead of LSD, you had ecstasy, E, MDMA, everywhere.
Absolutely. Thanks to Sasha Shulgin and the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Right. And you've still got that prevalent on the scene now. It's known as Molly these days. The latest nickname is Molly. It's basically MDMA. It's all over the electronic dance music scene, particularly in California, which has become the epicenter of it in the US. So, you know, the drug is there. Instead of LSD, it's ecstasy. Instead of psychedelic rock, you've now got electronic dance music. Instead of Woodstock and the Monterey Pop Festival, you've now got big open-air raves and warehouse parties and you know, big super clubs. So all the same kind of parallels are there. It's just being served up for a different generation on the other side of the Atlantic. But the reach of it and the cultural impact of it is every bit as big as what happens with the 60s counterculture. And just a couple of interesting establishment links coming out of this scene that I've uncovered for the new book. The biggest kind of high-profile dance music club coming out of London in the early 1990s was the Ministry of Sound, and is still around to this day. And the guy behind Ministry, which was very much modeled on the Paradise Garage coming out of New York, this very iconic disco club, which, you know, the Ministry of Sound was modeled on it. So the guy behind it went by the name of James Palumbo. And he was the grandson of an Italian immigrant who had made his fortune in property development, also the eldest son of a baron, Baron Peter Palumbo. And this guy, James Palumbo, that started the Ministry of Sound, has since become a baron himself. He's known as Baron Palumbo of Southwark. He's reckoned to be among the 400 richest people in Britain with an estimated fortune of £130 million, which is not a bad track record from running a nightclub. And he launched it with a fellow Etonian, Humphrey Waterhouse. And I think there might be an interesting clue in what he decided to call the club, as in Ministry of Sound, because, of course, ministries are connected to government, are connected to the establishment.
Religion, cult.
Yep. Palumbo was a close associate of Tony Blair's Labour Party kingpin, Lord Peter Mandelson, who is also known to be an affiliate of Baron Jacob Rothschild, frequently holidays with him in Corfu. And James Palumbo, the Ministry of Sound guy, is said to have given Mandelson the use of a chauffeur-driven car for the 1997 general election campaign. Isn't that interesting? Then we have one of the prominent promoters of some of these early raves that came out of Britain in the very early days of Acid House, by the name of Tony Colston Hayter. He was a public schoolboy, the son of a university lecturer and solicitor. He was also a gambling addict. But he turned out to be one of the key figures in the whole free party scene that got that whole movement off the ground. And he popped up again a few years later in 2014 when he pleaded guilty to being the leader of a group that had hacked into the main computer system of Barclays Bank and embezzled £1.3 million from its funds. And, you know, his past caught up with him and he had to answer for that. But interesting that those two were some key figures in that whole scene and what it went on to become. So here we are 30 years later, and we've got this absolute phenomenon. And it's really taken off in LA. You know, LA, for some reason, has become the key center for electronic dance music in the US. And I've really noticed that so much centers around California when it comes to social engineering. You know, why is that? You had the hippie thing coming out of San Francisco. You got Silicon Valley and the whole development of the internet and all of that. It's always
the Presidio and the pedophilia there and
Esalen Institute.
The Esalen Institute. You've got Bohemian Grove there. All of that. You know, and in fact, I wanted to mention to you that you know, I know one of the very first MDMA dealers, who's Robert Forty, whom I've had on the show, and well, he was influenced by Frank Barron, whom looks like he was CIA, but Sasha Shulgin, who invented MDMA, helped him set up one of the very first MDMA distribution labs. You know, and then Sasha Shulgin is working for the DEA and all of this stuff, and he's hanging out at Bohemian Grove along with Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead and these other guys. But, you know, you mentioned Tony Blair.
Yeah.
And, well, he was a Fabian, and who else was a Fabian but our you know, we can't go without another mention of Aldous Huxley, right?
Absolutely. Let me just get my Huxley story in case we run out of time.
Sure. So
during the course of my research, this is unconnected to hip-hop or electronic dance music, but, you know, we can't leave out a Huxley. So going back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, there was this group coming out of the UK called the Tornadoes. They did a song called Telstar, which is an instrumental record. And they were managed by this guy called Joe Meek, who, would you believe it, just happened to be a paedophile. And he was part of this ring. And when he stood to be uncovered, when he was about to be exposed as having been part of this paedophile ring, he took a shotgun and blasted the landlady of his boarding house to death before turning the gun on himself. Nice man. But anyway, this group that he managed, the Tornadoes, they had a member by the name of Rob Huxley. And in his autobiography, this guy, Rob Huxley, says that he did a bit of digging into his genealogy, and he was amazed. Imagine his surprise to discover that he's actually a fourth cousin of Aldous Huxley.
Huxley, yeah.
Eugenicist.
Is that a coincidence, or do we see, you know, Huxley family running MKUltra and in Australia and over here running eugenics and running this over there and promoting Darwinism over there, you know? I mean, and this should be a good connection for you. Animal Huxley worked with a band and worked with Vito Pelecas in Los Angeles. And Aldous Huxley, of course, lived right off of Mulholland or on Mulholland, right outside of Laurel Canyon.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you have all these connections going back into the worlds of academia and government and the intel services and secret societies and, you know, mystery school teachings and stuff. At what point are people going to say this goes beyond coincidence? And it's clear that these organizations are putting their key players into these prominent positions in the entertainment industry to fulfill agendas and to, you know, have a mind controlling effect on the general public. You could write off 6 or 7 of them. You might even write off 12 or 15 of them. But when you get it time and time and time again, and the exception to the rule becomes the special event, then, you know, how much is your denial going to prevent you from seeing what's right in front of your brain?
Right. It's like, you know, how many times do you have to see the military intelligence background behind the parents of a music band? I mean, it's like, oh, come on. Again, you know, it's just so often, it's absurd.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's some stuff that's coming in the next book. The parallels between the electronic dance music scene and the whole acid house thing and the counterculture scene of the 60s and much more into the toxification of hip-hop, because this is something that's close to my heart, you know. When I first started out, the music was a lot more meaningful than it is now. You got uplifting messages from it. There were some great records sampled as well. You know, hip-hop producers used to take old soul and funk records and recreate the bass lines to make the new track. Everything now is electronic. Everything is digital, including how the message is delivered to consumers. You know, streaming is everywhere now. People are just listening to MP3s on their shitty little speakers, their tinny little mobile phone speakers, you know. Everything has changed, and even the art of DJing has changed. And one thing I've noticed is that this goes hand in hand with what's happening to people's attention spans. It's another aspect of social engineering. So people have such diminished attention spans now, particularly young people, because it's always the younger generation that are in the sights of the social engineers. You know, they don't bother with people of my age because they just think I'm an irrelevance. They're just waiting for my generation to die off. They're always after the younger people of any generation. That's what they did in the 60s, of course. The whole counterculture thing was aimed at the baby boomers, basically, that were coming of age in the mid-60s. And it's no different what they're doing now. They're after the millennials. They're after kids that were born around about the year 2000, you know, and they're doing a big number on them. So you've got dwindling attention spans. And I lay a lot of the blame for that at the door of things like Instagram and Snapchat, these social media phenomena. So Snapchat is this thing where you're supposed to record a very brief bit of dialogue about what you're doing on your mobile phone. You film a little 15, 20 second video and say, hey guys, I'm here at the club and I'm listening to this tune and I'm here with so-and-so and we're having a drink. Catch you soon. And you put that out there and somebody will watch it, somebody in your social circle, and go, oh yeah, right, okay. And then they forget it as soon as it's done. Now you've got to do another one because that's irrelevant now. That's old news. So there's this pressure on young people to constantly keep their Snapchat updated. It's the same thing with Instagram. You take a picture, you post it online. Everyone goes, oh yeah, right. Then they forget it and it's gone. Now you've got to do another one. And I see how this is playing out with when you're DJing in a club now. It used to be the case that you could play a record for 3 or 4 minutes and hold the attention of the dance floor and people would respond to that record and react to it in the right way. Now you see DJs drop in a verse and a chorus of a tune. By the time they've got 90 seconds into it, everyone's attention span has dwindled to the point that they've got their mobile phones out, they're looking at their smartphone, they're going to the toilet, they're going off for a drink, you know, because they're used to having everything served up to them instantly. They want it right now, and they get bored very, very quickly. So if you're not changing the record every minute to 90 seconds and chopping in verses and choruses the whole night, then you're not going to hold the attention of the dance floor. So it's just another aspect of the way social engineering is going hand in hand with this transhumanist, technological, futurist society that we now have.
Hey, Mark, who came up with the term transhumanism?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, that was, it's been a few minutes. I just had to slip it in. Julian Huxley.
Had to be a Huxley. He's the guy that popularized the tinfoil hat as well, right?
Yes, I believe, yes, you are correct on that. And I did have an article on that. I do believe that's in the Brain Database as well.
Okay.
Very
interesting. Are we out of time?
We started about 11, 12 minutes late, so it looks like we still have about 8, 9 minutes left.
All right, then. So, what else should we talk about?
Well, you know, have you looked, you know, this, of course, electronic dance music goes over into Burning Man, and then you have this culture, Burning Man culture, and they create these subdivisions of culture within the electronic music, just like they've done within rap culture, like you used to have gangster rap back in the day. And then that was kind of pushed aside. But there's all of these subdivisions within the music. Like you have your MDMA music. You have your more LSD-type music. You have your more mushroom-type music. Like Goa Gill is more LSD and mushrooms, whereas Darude is more, anthem music, really poppy, really fast. But, you know, they're catering the music and dividing the music. The Burning Man groups, you have the Dress, you have all of it. It's catered to specific groups and subdivisions, just like they did with rock music, like we exposed in Music, Mind Control, and Psychobiology with Hans Utter.
Right. And with hip-hop, it just feels like they're really doing a number on the black community, and they have been for quite some time. And it's long been my view that the controllers, the elites, the social engineers, the dark occultists, call them what you will, have contempt for all of society. For,
absolutely.
For we profane ones, you know, if we're not part of their group. But I think they reserve a particular brand of contempt for black people. And I think we've seen this play out in so many ways over the decades. So they flooded the black communities, the ghettos of all the big cities with crack cocaine. There was the AIDS epidemic, which targeted or very much affected those communities as well. There's been street violence, gang violence. There's this great scene in the movie Boys in the Hood, fantastic movie from 1991. You have Lawrence Fishburne's character who's trying to school and educate his teenage son and prevent him from falling into gangs and into criminal lifestyles. And he takes him on this tour of this black ghetto. And he points out the fact that in every black community, you have two things that you constantly see, a liquor store and a gun store. And he points out that this is the way that they're just allowing these black communities to kind of destroy themselves from the inside. So all these things have kind of affected black communities in so many ways. And then on top of that, what I've seen happening over the past 20 years or so is hip-hop, this art form, this culture, has also been turned against them. I mean, obviously, a lot of white people listen to hip-hop as well, and in fact, the main consumer group that keeps that whole industry alive, that buys most of the albums, is middle-class white males. So when you get groups like NWA and Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and Nas and Jay-Z and people like that, it is primarily middle-class white males who are buying those albums.
But of course, I think that's very intentional as well, too. I think you have, just like we expose with like what the CIA did in Oaxaca, Mexico, with Maria Sabina, et cetera. But the attack is working both directions. You know, just like we expose in the Manufacturing the Deadhead article with, you know, discussing what Edward Bernays was promoting. You know, I mean, if you look at the high classical work, and a few weeks ago I interviewed E. Michael Jones discussing this, and the promotion of the Dionysian Mysteries to get people caught up in sex, drugs, and rock and roll, breaking apart the family, breaking apart society, and all of this stuff. But, you know, the middle-class white kids can't be unaffected by this stuff as well. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be impacting everyone across the board.
Sure. So you've had this degeneration of the music, as I said, lyrically, in terms of the production. And there was this phase which came out a few years ago of hip-hop records, or so-called hip-hop, because I don't even consider it to be that anymore, which had these stupid little dance routines which came with them. It's like line dancing. So they would come with their instructions for what kids are supposed to do in the club when these records come on. And of course, most young people hearing these instructions don't think to question it. They don't think to exercise any kind of independent thought. So they just go along with it. And they do all these stupid little dances and stuff. And some of the dances are based on nursery rhymes. So it's almost like they're taking the piss. They're regressing you back to an infantile state of mind. And they're even giving you little subtle clues. And there was a rapper by the name of Scarface who came out in an interview a few years ago. And, you know, he made comments to the effect that they're just making black people look fucking stupid, man, you know, with these tunes. They're just making us look infantile and just ridiculous. And I think he had a very good point. But yeah, I just really see the music being turned against these people. And you have to go back a very long time to find any kind of meaningful message in any mainstream so-called hip-hop records. I mean, there is the underground stuff still being made, and you have pioneers like Public Enemy and Dead Prayers and people like that that have been around for years that are still making great music. But you never hear it on the radio. You'll never see it on rotation on video channels. You'll never hear it in the club. You've got to look very hard to find it. And to my mind, the only record of the past 20 years that had anything vaguely meaningful to say was probably Where Is the Love by the Black Eyed Peas, which is a group that since has gone absolutely down the route of being complete mind control stooges. And they're pushing the transhumanist AI agenda big time now, particularly their frontman Will.i.am. But I think it was 2003, they put out this record, Where Is the Love? And they're talking about, you know, where is the love in the world? And why is everything corrupted? And why is everything gone to pot? And there's this line in there where they call out the CIA. Basically, they just say the big old CIA. They're listing all the problems that the world faces. So a few weeks ago, we had this spate of terror, so-called attacks in the UK, including this event at the Manchester Arena at that Ariana Grande concert where this Islamic terrorist is said to have blown himself up with a bomb in the foyer of this arena. And there was a benefit concert that was staged in the wake of that event with a whole host of, you know, puppeteered stooges from the industry that were lined up to perform. One of the acts was the Black Eyed Peas. They come on stage, they do their big hit, Where Is the Love? And they leave out the line about the CIA. It's completely missing from the lyrics.
Wow.
So, even that song has been completely neutered now.
Hey, Mark, what do you think of that meeting that they talk about, the secret meeting that changed rap music and destroyed a generation? What do you think about that letter?
Well, that letter has all the hallmarks of being a genuine piece to me. I've looked into it. There are a lot of people that claim it's a hoax, but then you get people that claim that everything's a hoax. To me, it carries a lot of feasibility. The story is that this record industry executive was called to a meeting at a private residence somewhere in LA in 1991. And at this meeting, There were a whole bunch of other record industry executives that this guy knew and recognized that had all been called here. And they wheeled out a couple of guest speakers. None of these people knew who they were, but these two guys introduced themselves as being representatives of the US private prison industry, prison for profit, in other words. And they said to these record industry guys that what they wanted to do was to work in conjunction with them to change the nature of rap music in terms of the sort of stuff that was going into the lyrics. And they wanted to start glorifying criminal lifestyles, knowing that the gullible, naive fan base of this music, if they heard their favorite rappers talking about gangbanging and running drugs and pimping and all this sort of stuff, would try and emulate their heroes, get themselves embroiled in all kinds of petty crime situations, then the private prison industry, working in conjunction with the corrupt police and the corrupt judiciary, would have a constant supply of young, primarily black males that they could fill out these prisons with. And full prisons mean vast profits for all the investors involved in it. So what they said to these record guys was, we can work together on this, you can have shares in this project, and we're all going to get very, very rich. And the story is that this one particular guy was horrified by what he was hearing, wanted no part in it, and asked to leave the meeting. And he was escorted out at gunpoint, so he says, and sworn to secrecy to never divulge what was said in that meeting. And he says that about 20 years later, his conscience got the better of him. He could no longer live with himself, and he just had to come out and expose what he'd been a part of. So he didn't give his name, although I guess it wouldn't be that difficult to track down who he was if you knew who attended that meeting. And it's for this reason that a lot of people say, oh, it's probably a hoax, and you know, it didn't really happen. But look at the way the music went from that point on, 1991. You know, you could pinpoint that as the start of the real degeneration and corruption and bastardization of this music. And it very much does tally with that meeting. And what I have come to understand about the true nature of the industry and the private prison for profit industry makes this a very feasible scenario to me. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
I agree with you, and that was a good analysis. I mean, when you look at that and then you fast forward, you see the whole thing, but you see it, you know, across all the music. You know, it's like back in the 80s and 90s, you had the alternative music that comes in, and it's one thing. I listen to what's coming out now, and it's not even stuff I can stand, you know. And every 10 years, if you go on the satellite radio, you just hit... they have the stations by decade, and you hit the 50s. There used to be a 40s one. I think they got rid of it. You hit the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, 90s, etc., and you see distinct changes in the style of music every decade. And I think that's all done intentionally, too, so that it creates a false generational gap between parents and children, and then you have the subdivisions of the music creating false divisions between the children themselves, divide and conquer.
Yeah, well, I can't stand to listen to the stuff that's on the radio now. And I know there's probably an element of me getting old, and, you know, people younger than me would just consider me to be an old bastard that's out of touch with stuff. But I think there's more to it than that.
I agree.
You know, I can pinpoint the sound frequencies, the production styles that's going into so-called hip-hop records now. To me, it sounds straight satanic, because I've looked a bit into how dark occultists work and how they do things like cast hexes and spells on master recordings. And people can scoff at that and think there's no foundation to it at all, but don't be so quick to dismiss it, because I think there's a lot of foundation to that as well. And when I listen to so many of these sounds, they just make me want to reach for the off button. And many other people in my generation say the same thing. So I have these discussions with people of my age, other DJs, audio engineers, producers, and they say the same thing. So 20-year-olds love this stuff, but, you know, 45-year-olds can't stand to listen to it. So what's that all about? They're after right. A particular generation. And because they've been groomed and shaped and molded with this type of sound, they consider it completely normal. They consider that it speaks to them. That's the music of their generation. And guys of my age are completely out of touch with that, because we remember better times, better days, better music as we see it. And you could speak to my dad and ask him about it, and he would say the music I grew up with was straight garbage because it was different to his music. So it certainly is a generational thing. And they're always after the young people, like I said earlier. They're the ones that are so easy to mind control. They've got no point of reference. They can't remember what the world used to be like, particularly with all this technological stuff, you know, the transhumanist, futurist society. Young people now are just completely locked into their smartphones. They do everything online. They do everything in electronic ways. They have no point of reference for how things used to be. You know, they're learning to drive in cars with inbuilt sat-nav. If the sat-nav broke down and they're out in the middle of nowhere, they would have no clue how to read a map to get back to civilization, because the skill of map reading is gone because your goddamn car does everything for you now.
Right.
And these are all symptoms of this society, these times in which we live. And young people are always, you know, the target of it.
You know, and for anybody who doubts the Satanism in music, check out our Music, Mind Control, and Psychobiology series with Dr. Hans Utter. And we lay it all out there. There's no doubt in it. It's spread everywhere throughout the music. Mark, thanks so much for your time tonight. I know it's late for you. You're probably about ready to go pass out.
Yeah, no worries, man. Sorry about the technical issues earlier. Literally 5 minutes before I was due to connect with the call, my internet connection went down for no apparent reason. It's been fine all week. I had to reboot my laptop, reboot the router. We got there in the end, but apologies for the mishaps at the start.
No problem. Do you have a website you want to give out, titles of your books, etc.?
Right, so the book that's out at the moment is Musical Truth. You can get that on Amazon. If you want to get a copy from me direct, you're welcome to email me, mark@markdevlin.co.uk. There's a website for the book, musicaltruthbook.com. Volume 2 is being written right now, and I'm aiming to get that out in the new year, early in the new year, probably late January. So there's many more stories to tell, and a lot of what I've spoken about this evening is going to be in Volume 2.
Look forward to it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for your time tuning in tonight. Please support the show, GnosticMedia.com. Check out Mark's work, and we'll see you next week. I believe we have Curtis Duncan returning to continue the line of research that he's done into the manufacturing of transgender, etc., as eugenics. So we'll see you all then. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.